So welcome to everyone for this two-week series, Kabbalah and Meditation. We're going to try and just explore a little bit the complexity of the human personality. This course really is a bit of a preview to hopefully a longer course we're going to hold next year, because the human being is a complex machine, not something that can be understood in 2 weeks. But hopefully in these 2 weeks, we're going to try and sort of get some highlights and headlines, so to speak, together with some practical strategies in terms of managing our own behavior and our own choices. So what we're going to do is we're going to begin with a Kabbalistic concept, but theoretical, but esoteric, just to give us some understanding of the human makeup, which will lead into a practical sort of strategy or perspective on managing our choices, managing our responses, managing our behavior, and so on. So when God created the world, we talk about the 6 days of creation together with the seventh, which is Shabbat. On the sixth day, we know He created the first human being, which became known as Adam. Why was Adam called Adam? So we have two reasons, an interesting combination, either end of the spectrum. On the one hand, Adam is called Adam because Adama comes from the Hebrew word Adama, which means that the human being, the man, was created from the earth. God gathered together the clay of the earth and formed the image of the human being and then blew into him a neshama, a soul of life. Unlike every other creation, which was created from nothing, where God said, let there be light, let there be plants, let there be animals, and so on and so forth. When it came to Adam, he took afar min ha'adama, he took dust from the earth, which is the one reason why the person, the human being, is called Adam. That's as far as the body is concerned. But Adam is also called Adam because of the soul. And there it's an opposite reason. The reason for being called Adam is because Adam comes from the word Adameh, which our rabbis tell us is Adameh la'elyon, which means the word Adameh means, from the Hebrew word dimyon, to be compared to be similar to. So the human being is called Adam because we are similar, so to speak, to the supernal man. We are have similarities to God, so to speak. Right. Is it very warm in here? Just doing it, yeah? Huh? Feel a bit stuffy now? What's the vote? Yeah, yeah? Do you want to just give the press the thing? Do you mind? Just there's a switch there. Yeah, thanks. Okay. Just the thing in the right-hand corner. That's it. If it gets too cold, let me know. Okay. So what does that mean, Adam El Elyon? So we know that our rabbis tell us that the human being... Come in. That the human being was created, but Tzelem Elokim. We always talk about the human being created in the image of God. Right? So what does that mean? Can this place here if you want? What does that mean to be created in the image of God? What does that mean? Anyone have any ideas? What does it mean human beings created in the image of God? What is that? God has no physical form as we know.
Intellect and emotion.
Oh, sure. Right into it. So let's take it slowly, and I'll share with you the Kabbalistic perspective of what it means when we talk about the human being created in the image of God. And this is an important perspective to know, to understand our own makeup, right? So in order to do this, we have to have a look at what we know to be called the tools of creation. What does that mean? So let's start from the beginning. When we talk about God, we talk about a truly infinite God. What does a truly infinite God mean? A truly infinite God means, let's say the definition of infinite, right? The definition of infinite Kabbalistically is that there is no definition. In other words, being truly infinite means that you're not limited to anything. So when we talk about God being infinite, as the Kabbalists explain, it means that God has no, the definition of God is that He's undefined. that he cannot describe him with any definition. You cannot even say that he's tremendously smart, tremendously kind, tremendously compassionate. Because God, in his essence, transcends any form of definition. As soon as you say, as soon as you describe something, and you say something is something and not something else, that's a definition, and that's limiting, and that's finiteness. However, in other words, you can't even say spiritual. Sometimes people talk about God in the context of spirituality, as if we're physical and he's spiritual.
I love that phrase that God is kind, but it's compassionate.
Hold on a second. We're going to get there. Right. So when we talk about us being physical and him being spiritual, that's a mistake. Because spirituality is also a defined thing. Spirituality, by the way, the spiritual world and the spiritual beings and the spiritual energies that God created in the world are no less defined than the physical is. They have different frame of reference. They're less tangible. They might be more godly, but they're not God, if you know what I'm saying. However, and this is going to answer your question. There was a great Kabbalist called the Avodat HaKodesh. So think about this for a moment. This is going to sound a little bit interesting. And he said the following. He said that just as God is infinite and unlimited, you must say, he said, that God possesses, if he so wills, if he so wants to be, he possesses the ability to be finite as well. Why? Because if you say that God is only infinite and not finite, you've just made him finite. Get that? Yeah? No? If you say God can only be infinite, in other words, if we say that God is undefined and he must be undefined, then you made him finite. Because he's saying he's something and not something else. Right? So therefore, God, if he wants, he truly transcends all form of definition. What that means is that if he wants to be, he's undefined. But if he wants to be, he can be defined as well, if he wants to define himself. Why am I saying that? Because when God wanted to create a finite world, that was his desire, right? At the very beginning of creation, when God, as the Kabbalistic term goes, Allah birtsono, it rose in his will to create a world, a finite world, a world of a beginning and an end, a world of time and space. He wanted that world to be connected to him, not just to be something outside of him. And therefore what he did was he first chose, the first step to creation, Kabbalah teaches, the first step to creation was God chose to express himself in 10 specific ways. He brought out within himself, so to speak, 10 specific attributes, which we know in Kabbalistic terminology to be called the Sfirot. Those are the Sfirot. Why they're called Sfirot? There's a number of reasons. Sfirot means they tell a story. Sfirot means they reveal. Sfirot means they have a number, a finite number. Okay. And these Sfirot, his own attributes, which he chose to express himself in those 10 defined ways, right, are divided into two, in a general form. Three of them are intellectual, seven of them are emotional. Right? These are the sort of quick, brief translation of all the 10. But if you have a look on your handout on page 2, you'll see that I've put them into a three triangles. Three triangles and the 10th one at the bottom. And the reason for that is because that's the way they're structured. There's a formula that governs the Sfirot, of a formula of right, left, and middle. And on all the triangles, I didn't put them in a triangle over here, but on your handout you see there's a triangle. On all the triangles, all the ones on the right have a relation to each other, the ones on the left and the ones in the middle. Now, it's beyond the scope of tonight to go into all the 10 and understand exactly what they all are. We're going to leave that for another time. Hopefully we'll run another course to actually go into them in all detail, because it's a fascinating subject. But suffice to say for the moment that three of these are intellectual, seven are emotional. What does that mean? So what it means is as follows. You know, we are taught there's a verse that says that if you want to understand God, sometimes we can look at ourselves, because we are created in the image of these 10 powers, as we're soon going to explain. Right? So sometimes we can look at ourselves and see how it works with us, and then we can track back and sort of understand what it means in terms of God's own attributes, right? So the difference between intellect and emotion with us is this, that when we talk about our power of thought, our power to think, the power to think is a power where we think within ourselves. In other words, when I'm thinking, when I'm understanding something, I'm not responding to the outside. On the contrary, the power of intellect is to take something from the outside and absorb it so I can understand it. So intellect is about transferring something from the outside into my being, right? Or processing an idea, or creating an idea within myself. Intellect is not a response to the outside world. Emotion, by definition, what are emotions? What are feelings? Feelings are how we respond to things that are happening outside of us. Either practically or theoretically. In other words, I might have a feeling of kindness. I haven't done kindness yet, but I have a feeling of kindness means I have a feeling of kindness which is a relationship to something outside of me. I hate someone, God forbid, it means I have a response, I have a feeling which relates to someone outside of me, right? So too with God. When God decided to express himself in 10 very specific ways, now of course, these 10 sfirot, as we call them in Kabbalah, these 10 attributes of God, the way he expressed himself, are very different to ours. We can't compare our kindness with his kindness, our wisdom with his wisdom. Even those defined specific attributes in God's frame of reference are unlimited and infinite, but they're still specific definitions, right? But we can understand a little bit the properties of them. In other words, his intellect is the way he decided to process the plan, so to speak, the idea, the concept of creating a world. His emotions is how he actually relates to the world. In other words, God's 7 emotions, chesed, gevurah, tiferet, and so on, is his relationship to something, so to speak, outside of him. And I say so to speak because nothing's truly outside of God because God's all present, but that concept of creating a world which feels and looks like an entity outside of God, so to speak. Are we okay so far? Just, yeah? Stop me if I'm losing you. No, you're not convinced. You okay? Which explains why the world is created in 7 days. Now, we always talk about the 6 days of creation, but in fact it's 7. It's just very different. In other words, the 6 days of creation are when God created the 6 day, the world, and then the 7th day is that concept of malchut, the kingship, where he introduces serenity and peacefulness into the world, but the 7th day is also a part of creation. Why do we have 7 days of a week? Why does the creation take place in a process of 7? Because it corresponds to God's 7 emotions. In other words, Sunday is chesed, Monday is gevura, and so on and so forth. Okay? Which is why, by the way, everything in the world, everything that is created, corresponds and tracks back to one of God's 7 emotions. Just to give you an example. So we talk about fire and water, right? So from the first 2 emotions are chesed and gevura. That's the right and the left. Chesed is giving, calmness, compassion, flowing. Everything that's got to do with connecting and flexibility is about chesed. Gevura is more withdrawing, holding back, limiting, rigidity, rejection, all these things, right? Kabbalistically, we always talk about water being a symbol of chesed, fire being a symbol of gevura. Because water is flowing, water flows from top to bottom, water is a giving creation, whereas fire is a destructive creation and it's a withdrawing. Fire ascends, it goes back up, so to speak. It goes back to its source. It's a concept of gevura. Again, I'm just giving you the highlights. This is obviously a longer discussion, but just giving you an idea that everything in the world is created, that's created corresponds to one of the attributes. Or for the days of the week, for example. What did God do on the first day? Created light. Light is giving, light is chesed. It's brightness, it's clarity, it's showing the way, it's a benevolent creation. What did God do on the Monday? On the Monday we know that division was created, the concept of dividing things into compartments. But God took the water and he divided the upper waters from the lower waters. In fact, we are told that conflict was created on Monday, the concept of conflict. right? That's a gevura thing. So again, everything in the creation goes back and is connected to one of these seven sefirot, which is why the Arizal, the great Kabbalist, the Arizal explains why God, first step one of creation was for God to express Himself in these ten powers, and specifically the seven emotions, because He didn't want the world to be an entity which He can create. In other words, He's all powerful, so He can create a world which has no connection to Him. He wanted us to discover the connection in the world to Him, and therefore everything in the world connects to one of His attributes, one of His characters, so to speak. And when we understand that, we're able to discover godliness, we're able to connect the world to God in a much deeper way. Okay, so far we're good. Now, when it comes to the person, it's a little bit different. So when it comes to the person, it's the verse tells us that God gave us a soul. Okay. And that soul, it says that God blew into the nostrils of man a soul of life. Vayipach be'apav nishmat chayim. That's very interesting, because we know that God has no physical form. And therefore, it's always interesting that to examine the language that the Torah uses with regard to various things: God's hand, God's anger, God's outstretched arm, God's speech, God's blowing. What does all this mean? So obviously, God has no physical form. It's one of the fundamentals of our faith, actually. But what we do understand is that when a particular description or a particular language, a particular terminology is used in the Torah, it represents something that is distinct to that terminology, right? So the rest of creation, God creates through speech. God said, let there be light. God said, let there be an ocean. God said, let there be plants, and so on. When it comes to the human being, when it comes to the soul that we have, the neshama, it doesn't say God said, let there be a soul. God blew into the human being the soul of life. What's the difference? When we speech is external. Speech is a very deep idea, but speech is something which is not, a person is communicating to someone else. Speech relates to the outside of me. And speech is an external power, meaning a person can speak and speak and speak and not get tired. I'm sure you know lots of people like that. They can talk for hours and never get tired, right? Blowing is different. Why, when a person blows, you can't blow for that long, right? You blow up a balloon, it's going to, you know, after a while you get, why? Because when you blow, says the Zohar, that when a person blows, they blow from within themselves, right? So when God creates the world through speech, He's creating something external, connected to His attributes. Everything in the world connects back to one of the ten sefirot, to one of the seven emotions. But when He talks about, when he infuses us with a soul, He's not creating us with the ten powers, He's infusing us with His ten powers. Very different. In other words, He's, so to speak, giving part of Himself, if we can understand it that way, and in a diluted form, obviously, but He's giving part of Himself into the human being to create life within the human being. That's only the human being has that description of blowing. Okay, that's why we go back and we understand this concept that the human being is created in the image of God. What does it mean, the image of God? It means in the image of these ten sefirot, that we have ten powers, just like God's ten powers. We have three powers of intellect. We have seven emotions, right? Our intellect is the same like God's. That was where we think things within ourselves. We process information within ourselves. Our emotions of how we react and respond to the world outside of us. And the person's personality, where does our personality live? It lives in the world of emotion. It lives in our feelings. That's where our person, if you want to tell a person's personality, you won't tell it from the way they think, you'll tell it from the way they react, the way they respond to things around them. Okay. Now in that soul, just to get a bit of a picture, some of you have heard this from me before, there are actually five layers of the soul. Because different parts of the soul live on different layers. And we talk about the conscious of the soul and the subconscious of the soul. And this, again, this is also in the image of God. God works the same way. So when we talk about the ten powers that we have, the three intellectual and the seven emotional, they live on the first three layers of the soul. And it's called nefesh, ruach, and neshama. You've got it on your handout as well. Page four, thank you. Where the behavior, which really has to do with the seventh emotion, it's the implementation, lives on the outer layer of the soul. The next layer is ruach, which is the emotions. Neshama represents the cognition, the power to think. Those were the three intellectual powers live. And then we've got two layers of the soul, which we know as the subconscious, the chaya and yechida. The chaya one is where our will, our desire lives. Just like with God, before he expressed himself in the 10 specific powers, there was something driving those 10 powers. And what drove those 10 powers is the power of ratzon, the power of desire, the power of will. God desired to have a world. God wanted to express himself in these 10 ways. That's the driver behind the 10 powers. That's our ratzon as well, our will, our drive. And then we have what's called the yechida, which is the essence of the soul. It's the point of the soul. It's the depth of the soul. It's the purity of the soul. In fact, it's that part of the soul which is really almost, as we say, a spark of the divine. That's the essence of the soul. That's the level of yechida. Now, I'm going to show you something very esoteric. It's got to do with the Hebrew alphabet. If you have a look on page 5, when it comes to the 10 powers that we have, the 3 intellectual powers and the 7 emotions, Kabbalah is a very interesting term for these powers. The 3 intellectual ones are called the 3 mothers. Okay? Gimel Imot. And the 7 emotions are called the 7 doubles. Why is that? So I want to concentrate more on the 7 doubles, but I'll just tell you quickly about the 3. So we know that one of the things that God used to create the universe, including us, is the letters of the alphabet. Right? So letters of the alphabet, the Aleph base, are not just a language, and not just a made-up language. Lashon HaKodesh, the holy tongue, Hebrew, original Hebrew, not biblical Hebrew, is a holy language because it carries within it all kinds of divine formulas. And God created the world with the 22 letters of the alphabet. Okay? Those 22 letters of the alphabet, we are taught, divide into 3 categories. They divide many ways, but in terms of this discussion, they divide into 3 categories. The first category is the Aleph, the Mem, and the Shin, which refer to, and I'm not going to go into now why, but they refer to the 3 powers of intellect, what we call Chochmah, Bina, and Daat. And it has to do with the right, the left, and the middle. Okay. What I want to focus on more is, if you look on still page 5, we talk about the 7 doubles. The 7 doubles are represented by the 7 letters, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, Kaf, Pei, Resh, Taf. You'll see why I'm going down this path in a minute, because it's a very important idea. Does anyone know what these 7 letters stand for? What's special about these 7 letters? Yeah, no, so the letters have different meanings, different contexts, but not in this context. This context, something specific about these 7 letters. Beit, Gimel, Dalet, Kaf, Pei, Reish, Taf. Right? What's unique about these letters is that they're doubles. What I mean is, they're the 7 letters of the alphabet that can come with a dot or without a dot. Like you have a bet and a vet. Right? You have a gimel with a gimel without a dot. Which, by the way, we pronounce the same, but actually the Temanim, the Yemenite Jews, have a very specific way of pronouncing it, if it's got a dot or hasn't got a dot. Interesting. Like just like we say bet or vet, they say gimel or jimel. We don't have a G, by the way. The Ashkenazi or even the Sephardi Jews don't have a G in the alphabet, which is very fascinating. But the Temanim do. They have all the sounds. That's probably the most authentic way of pronouncing Hebrew. Like we don't have a th. Ashkenazim and Sephardim don't have a th, a th. The Temanim do. Correct. Right. So these 7 letters come in 2 forms, with a dot or without a dot. In Kabbalah what that means is, with a dot they're considered hard letters, called kasher, like they're hard, they sound softer without the letters. Right? So like a pei or a fei, right? So Pe is a harder sounding letter, a Fe is a weaker sounding letter. What that means is as follows. That when God infused us with seven emotions, those seven emotions can go either way. They can destroy us. Emotions are a very critical part of the person. But they can destroy us or they can build us. Emotions can be very unhealthy. They can be extremely destructive. They can destroy us and those around us. They can create negative energy. Or emotions can carry us towards healthy relationships, towards passion, towards enthusiasm, towards depth of life, towards an amazing elevation. They can be unholy, they can be holy. They can be animalistic, they can be refined. Right? Emotions are a very, very powerful force. And it's the most powerful force within the person. The hardest to control. Our emotions are the hardest to control. And they're an incredible, incredible force. I'll just show you how it relates to these seven letters. If you take these seven letters, they make up two words. That's why I've divided it up that way. Beged. Right? Beged. And Kafras, it's called, right? Beged Kafras. Those are the seven letters that can have dots or not have dots. What does the word Beged mean? You know, in Hebrew, it's interesting. Words have two different translations. Sorry? Clothing, right. Or it can mean in Hebrew, if you look in Tanakh, it can mean to rebel. Leave God. Begida is to rebel. Right? The next word, if you look at it, Kafrat. Kafrat can mean lichpor, to deny. The word for heresy in Hebrew is kfira. It's a negative thing. If one denies God's existence, if one goes against God, it's called kfira. But also the word kafras comes from the same root as kapara, which means atonement, cleansing, purity, Yom Kippur. See that? So when God gave us the seven emotions, these seven emotions are called seven doubles. Because they're a powerful force that can result in one of two pathways. Either rebelliousness, heretical experiences, negativity, or it can be something that enhances us, like a beged, like clothing. Clothing enhances the human being. The Talmud refers to clothing as the kavod of a person, the dignity of a person. And kapara, which is atonement, which is cleansing, which is purity. Right? And it's our choice to decide how those seven emotions are going to be utilized. But this is the crux of what I wanted to get to, really. That our soul has many, many layers to it. The most powerful part of the soul, the most powerful part of our personality, where our personality is expressed, where our personality really is revealed and expressed in its strongest way, is our emotions. And it's there we have to really work on where they're going to go. It can be doubles, it can go in a very negative pathway, or it can become a very enhancing experience, and there can be healthy emotions. How does it all work? So here comes the formula of what it means to be a human being. We have a concept in Kabbalah and in many, many sources that the two, because we talked about this ten, we have these ten powers, three of them are intellectual, seven are emotional. So the physical body, by the way, also reflects the ten powers. Sorry, it's too cold.
I didn't get a
vibe. You can turn it off if you want. Jonathan, you want to turn it off?
Huh?
Yeah? Okay, we're okay? Okay, good. One of the most complicated things in every shul is the air conditioning. Okay. So we have a Kabbalistic idea that for a person, for a healthy human being to be in control of themselves, they have to control oneself means to be a king over oneself. And the word for king in Hebrew is melech, right? Melech, a king. And melech is made up of three words. I didn't put it up there, but three letters, mem, lamed, chaf, which we are taught stands for moach. Moach means the brain. Lamed stands for lev, which is the heart. And the chaf stands for kaved, which is the liver. And Kabbalistic, what that means is the moach, the brain, is where we think. The lev is where we feel. The emotions live in the heart. They extend to the right hand is chesed, the left hand is gvura, and so on. But the epicenter of emotion is in the heart. And kaved, the liver, represents behavior, for whatever reason. And the way a person is supposed to behave, the true human being, so to speak, not the animalistic human being, but the true human being, is one where the head controls the heart, right? In order to ensure that the emotions run the course of healthy emotions and become something which we use to enhance our relationships and to respond to the world outside of us in a positive way, we can only do that if the brain guides the heart. Which, by the way, is why the three intellectual components of the human being is called mothers, because the mother, the parent, is supposed to give birth to the child, and our brain should be the one giving birth to our emotions. In other words, rather than our emotions being impulsive and reactive on their own, which normally lands up as negative emotions, our emotions are supposed to be born out of and developed from and guided by and inspired by proper thinking and rational thinking, where we make decisions and we're able to pause and we're able to make proper decisions between right and wrong and the appropriate response to the outside world. Okay? Which in turn inspires the way we behave, obviously. Now here's the problem. Why does this often not happen? Why do some people not express their emotions being guided by their thinking process, right? Not because they don't know the idea. So let's take an example, or two examples. A person gets angry, and while they're getting angry, they know it's wrong. That's why they're still getting angry, right? Or we get anxious about things, right? So we get stuck in traffic and we're late to an appointment. So we get very, very anxious and very frustrated. Why? Because we feel that if we come late, the whole world is going to fall apart. Even though we know in our brain that's untrue. The world won't fall apart. It'll remain. It'll be fine. So why does it happen? Why can't we control ourselves sometimes? And the reason is this. It's not because we don't have the ideas, it's because we don't give the ideas a chance to kick in. Because what happens is, the personality of the person lives within the emotions. And emotions are stronger and faster than the mind. So the heart races a lot faster than the mind does. Okay? So therefore, this concept of the mind controlling the heart and the mind ruling the heart requires an incredible presence of mind. It requires an incredible presence and strength of the mind. So people say, like, I know I shouldn't get upset, or I know I shouldn't be jealous, or I know I shouldn't overindulge. But I know is not good enough, because that's a background thought which is way behind. It's not even equal in the race. Right? It's just a fleeting, haphazard sort of thought where it comes in our mind, we're not really properly in control of our mind, we don't have the strength of the mind. And that's why the whole being, the whole personality is taken over by the heart. In order for the brain to rule the heart, in order for the mind to control the emotions, we need to take control of our mind. This is the point. In other words, our personality will develop in our heart, not in our mind. But in order for the personality to develop positively in our heart, we need to take amazing control of our mind, to be fully conscious, to fully understand, to be fully focused on where we are and what we're thinking about, and be able to have the mind hold the emotions back and create a space where we can choose how we're going to respond emotionally. That's where the concept of mindfulness comes in, right? Mindfulness is an old ancient Jewish concept. Different names, but it's an old Jewish idea. Right? It wasn't made up by anyone else. It's all there in the Torah in many, many, many different forms. Now, sometimes people talk about mindfulness as the concept of living in every moment, experiencing the potential of every moment properly, not being distracted by the previous moment, the moment to come, and so on and so forth. But it's much more than that. It's not just about living in each moment, right? Being really mindful means that we have the strength of the mind, which gives us the ability to control the way we respond. Okay? Because as we said before, our emotions, our feelings, are about responding to the outside world. So the way Stephen Covey puts it, for example, in The Seven Habits, sorry, I forgot to say this, but that's right. Yeah. Is the way the world works is as follows, right? We have stimulus and response. So something happens and we respond. So someone cuts us off in the traffic, someone says something hurtful, someone pushes our buttons, something happens, our day goes out of control, things we expect to happen didn't happen, someone, God forbid, is not well, whatever the case is, that's the stimulus. Then there's our response. Now what happens often is this, that the stimulus happens and right away the heart wants to respond. And the emotions are very fast. Once they respond, it's over. Once, I'm sure you've had this experience before where you, or if you haven't, you're a good person and I have a lot of respect for you. But if you're normal, then you probably had this experience where you lost your temper. And as you're losing your temper, as you're going off, you know it's wrong and you can't hold back. You can't control yourself, right? For some of us people, that's an experience we've had, right? So why is that? Because once the emotions are set in motion, once they're off, there's no holding them back. So where does the free choice happen? Where does it live? It lives in a very small space between the stimulus and response. Or we create the space to be a little bit bigger. As Stephen Covey says in the 7-Habit Model, we create the pause. That we train ourselves to pause so we can think. So we don't let the emotions respond so we can think. And it's in that space of thinking where free choice lives. We decide and we choose whether we should respond or how we should respond. And then we try and steer and guide the emotions to respond in a healthy, appropriate way, even if it's not what we feel like doing. Okay? Even if it's not our instinct, even if it's not our impulse. But that space is incredibly important. And that space requires incredible mindfulness. It requires incredible control of the mind. And control of the mind is something that a lot of us don't have today properly. Because our mind is all over the place. We don't have a good attention span nowadays. We're rushing from one thing to another. We have things bombarding us from all directions. We have technology which is supposed to help us, but doesn't help us. It actually does the opposite. I mean, it's very helpful in certain areas, but it takes away our attention. And we're not in the moment, and we're not thinking. We have ideas. We're not unintelligent people. We're very intelligent people, but we don't have control of the mind. And therefore, we're not thinking consciously. We're not mindful. We're not actually taking every moment and saying, hold on a second, let me give thought to this. Who's in control in this moment? Is it my mind or is it my heart? This concept of being in control is an incredible idea. And it's the only way to develop as a human being, because developing as a human being means to refine our responses, to refine our emotions. Again, the personality, behavior is just an outcome of emotions, an outcome of a response. If you're angry with someone, you'll scream at them, you might hit them, you might do something to them, you might gossip against them, whatever the case is. Behavior is just an outcome of emotion, most of the time. But therefore, everything about our behavior will be about how our emotion develops. And if we let our emotion run wild, if we don't have that power of the mind, if we don't take control of our mind, then we can't develop our emotions. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Is there space for an emotional response?
Sorry?
Is there space for an emotional response?
What do you mean a space for emotional response?
So when your gut feels,
where does that feel? We'll talk about that in a minute. So gut feel is a very dangerous thing, and I'll explain to you why in a minute. Because even gut feel needs a lot of thinking. We'll come to that in a second. Now, let's take it even a step deeper. Some of you heard this from me before, this idea, but sometimes the mind isn't good enough, the conscious mind. And the reason is because it's something called a stuck mind. You know, sometimes people try to focus, they go through a difficult time, they try to develop a thought pattern, they try to reframe things, and it just doesn't work. Keep coming back to the same problem. Keep coming back to the same thought pattern. So the mind is an interesting thing because although our thinking gives us the ability to decide to do something different. And when our mind is in control, we can decide to respond one way or the other. We make a choice between one response or the other. But if we have certain ideas within our mind that we're stuck in, then it's not going to help us to be in control of the mind. Okay? And therefore, what sometimes needs to happen is we need to allow ourselves to go deeper than the mind. What do I mean by that? To use the mindful approach, which I'll explain in a minute, to actually go deeper than the conscious mind. Because what we need to always acknowledge is that the mind is not the first step of the human being. Although the mind is incredibly powerful, and the mind gives us the ability to make choices, but our mind is actually not the highest form of human existence. Because the mind is often influenced by what happens in the subconscious. Right? Because actually our subconscious is even deeper and larger and more powerful than our conscious mind. Okay? And therefore, when we really focus and when we really become mindful, and this is where the concept of meditation comes in as well, the concept of really being in control of our mind and properly focusing, what we learn to do is not just to be mindful and understand what is going on so we can use the power of intellect to make decisions and to make the right choices, but it also allows us to surrender and to open ourselves up to something new and something fresh, something different, which will come from the subconscious. Because the subconscious is much more infinite than the conscious mind. The conscious mind is very finite. And when we are used to a certain paradigm and used to a certain way of thinking, we have to be ready to open ourselves up to a new way of thinking, to a new idea, to a new perspective, to a new way of doing it, a new outlook, a new paradigm, a new fresh look at the whole process. However, what we need to understand is, and this becomes really, really important. In order to do that, first of all, we do it through the mind. In other words, like this, the mind is an amazing thing. The way we enter the subconscious is through the conscious. Because we are taught that the conscious mind is made up of three parts. Chokhmah, Binah, and Dad. I didn't put it on the thing, but the first power of thinking is Chokhmah. And Chokhmah is like a bridge. That first power of thinking is like a bridge between the conscious and the subconscious. Let me explain that for a minute. When we understand an idea, when we understand a concept really, really well, in intellectual terminology, that's called Bina. That's why we call ourselves Bina, because it's a place of learning, right? So Bina means to understand. The word Bina also comes to the word Binyan, which is to create a building. When you understand something well, when you process information, you give it breadth, depth, and you create an intellectual edifice, that's called Bina. In other words, it's an intellectual building. Okay. However, often what people do is they understand something, but within a certain context. But God gave us a power of thinking which is above Bina. It's called Chochmah. Chochmah is the idea of conception. It's the ability to conceive a new idea, to create a new spark. It's the conscious part of our brain that's the window and the doorway to the subconscious. Okay? It allows us to dig deeper into the soul and to find the subconscious, more unlimited part of our neshama, to be able to bring in new ideas, different perspectives, and a new paradigm. But here's the problem. And here's where we have to be very, very careful. And this goes to your question about a gut feeling. People say, I have to trust my gut feeling. I'm very skeptical of that. I'll tell you why. Because there are two things that live in the subconscious. Right? If you put it all together, there's two things. I mean, we can subdivide it between two souls, the animal soul and the godly soul, but for this discussion, let's just talk about two things that live in the subconscious that are both in the background of the human being, driving the conscious part of the human being. And that is the ego. And that's where Freud got stuck. And then there's something deeper than the ego, which is the essence of the soul, the selflessness of the soul, the divine of the soul, the purity of the soul, the moral conscious of the soul, the selflessness of the soul. Okay? Often when people say, I don't really know what to do, but I'm trusting my gut feeling, that gut feeling could be the ego, right? And not necessarily is it healthy. And you have to be really in tune. Is this like a selfish thing? I'm just trusting my gut feeling, that's what I want to do? Or am I surrendering to something deeper than that? I'm actually trying to find the moral conscious part of my soul, the infinity of my soul, the part of the soul that's still pure. You see, because the essence of every soul, and this is what we're going to sort of conclude with before we put it all together and try and practice this a bit, right? The depth of our soul is always pure. We can mess up all parts of our soul and have to repair and rebuild, but the essence of our soul is always pure. And the essence of our soul, going back to the very beginning, is that blowing, that's that spark that God blew into us. In other words, it's a spark of the divine, it's a spark of godliness. And therefore it carries within it the power of infinity. It carries within it infinite potential. It carries within it the power to be completely selfless and to think differently and to go out of ourselves and to grow and to be untrapped and to untrap our own mind. Right? Because if we remain trapped, then even if we're very conscious of the way we think, we can end up making the wrong decisions because we make it based on our own ego and our own paradigm, and we post-rationalize. So we decide to be very, very thoughtful, but we come up with a whole intellectual thing of why it was good to lose our temper. Because, you know, the mind can do all sorts of interesting things. The mind can rationalize anything at the end of the day, right? As powerful as the mind is, that's the power of the mind, and that's the downfall of the mind. The power of the mind is that it can think from different perspectives, and therefore we can make choices between wrong and right, but that's the downfall of the mind, that it can rationalize anything. It can come up with any perspective, right? There's a funny expression in the Talmud that says, to illustrate this, in the Talmud it discusses the very complex laws of purity and impurity. It's very complex laws, and it was more relevant in temple times. If you come into contact with a dead animal or dead rodent, you come impure, and before you can go to the temple, you need to go to mikveh, and so on and so forth. So one of the laws is if someone comes into contact with what's called a sheretz, a dead rodent, if you touch it, you become impure, and you can't go to the temple, you can't eat sacrificial meat, and all these kind of things. So if I come into contact with that, I become impure. So in other words, that's the source of impurity, correct? Whatever's the source of impurity is more impure than the impurity that I contract. So the Talmud says that gives an example of a distorted thinker. And Talmud says a distorted thinker is someone who can explain to you why a dead rodent is pure with 70 explanations. Now, it's absurd. I mean, the dead rodent is the source of impurity. It doesn't matter. The mind can do anything. The mind can change anything. Right? So the power of the mind is the downfall of the mind. And therefore, sometimes what we have to do is we have to untrap the mind. And that takes an incredible control of the mind. Because it takes a certain sense of being completely conscious of what is happening and completely conscious of the need to surrender the mind to something more pure and to be careful not to surrender it to the ego, but to surrender it to the moral consciousness, the purity of our soul. And when we surrender it to the purity of our soul, when we understand that we have that soul, And we are given that fresh soul every single morning, as we say the Mode Ani, right? Then we understand that we can always start again. We can always change. We can always improve. We can always grow. Sometimes people think that they're trapped. They're trapped in a certain pattern of living because that's the way they always did it. So, you know, that's me. That's my personality. A human being is never trapped. Why? Number one, we always have the mind that can make a choice. It's always up to us to make the choice how to respond and how not to respond. And even when our mind is messed up, we always have that spark, that godly spark at the very depth of the soul that can give us that fresh start, that infinite start that will be able to repurify and redirect and re-guide and recalibrate, so to speak, the way we think, so that we can make the proper choices. Yeah.
Do people have different levels of ego? What determines your level of ego?
That's a good question. I don't think people have different levels of ego. I think people have different ways of expressing the ego. Yeah, of course. I mean, so I think that it's safe to say that we all have an ego. That is true. How bad it is depends on one person to the next. I mean, some people seem to deal more. Seem to find it easier to deal with the ego than others. But by the way, being conscious of the fact that we have an ego is a very, very important thing, because everyone has an ego. That's why God created us, because the mission of life was to work through the ego. We all have a sense of selfishness, and the idea is to work through that to become more selfless. The problem is when people think they don't have an ego. That's really problematic, right? Because then they always talk themselves into it. Everything they do and choose is not coming from a point of ego. It's coming from a point of selflessness and purity, and that's the worst thing, because then there's no hope, right? Being conscious that we have that ego actually helps us work through it. And if we're not able to work through it, at least we know where it's coming from, so we can work through it slowly. Yeah.
How would we know if we're making a decision from ego?
Good question. Good question. So a number of answers to that. First of all, normally when it's to our own benefit, then it's a problem. In other words, you always have to know, like, what you know. Sometimes, if it's a difficult decision, it's probably a good decision, right? Because we our ego lets us slip into those decisions that are more comfortable. Number one. Second of all, that's why the ethics of the fathers tells us that it's so important to have spiritual mentors and friends that can support us, that can be objective, and that can help us out with those kind of decisions. And third of all, that's why we have a moral code. In Judaism, we have a set of moral ethics, a set of moral code, as the Torah. And the Torah, we believe, is a code of absolute morality. In other words, it's a code of morality that comes from outside of us, that sometimes we have to be prepared to submit to, so that we can know that that we have a moral compass. Because if we leave it up to ourselves, if human beings leave morality up to themselves, they can land in very, very dark places. The extreme example of that was during the war, right? The Nazis truly believed that they were doing a moral thing, because it was relative morality. And okay, that's a terrible extreme example, obviously, but on a subtle way, that can happen to anyone, where we think we're acting morally, but because we're coming from our own frame of reference. That's what we have to submit to, something outside of us. But the first step is we have to be prepared to understand that we have that within us. In other words, we have that purity within us to be able to change the way we think. So just to wrap that up, therefore, one of the ways to do this, and one of the tools to do this, is first and foremost to practice becoming aware, to practice becoming conscious. In other words, that thing that's lacking so much today. Like today, we know that stress exists on disproportionate levels to previous generations. That's a documented fact. The amount of anxiety, the amount of stress, the amount of anti-anxiety medication that's going around is epidemic proportions. It's unbelievable. Why? Because people are stressed about everything today, because part of that is because we don't stop and we don't pause and we don't let our mind think and we don't take control of our own mind, and we're not conscious of what's going on, and we're not mindful of each moment, and we're not able to create that pause. And that takes a lot of practice. And part of that practice is what we call mindfulness exercises. Part of that practice is releasing stress by proper breathing, by abdominal breathing. Part of that practice is to learn to focus, to learn to stop. Now, we're going to do a little bit of exercise soon, but it's not just the meditation exercise. Obviously, when we talk about mindfulness, it's an all-day thing. It's something that we have to learn to be mindful of the whole time. But it's like exercise. You know, being fit is not something only when you do at the gym. Being fit is a state of being. It's a healthy state of being, right? You enhance it when you do exercise. The same thing with the mind. We need to do mindful exercise. We need to practice that concept of focus, practice that idea of focusing without being distracted, practice that ability to be aware of where we are and what we're doing. Sometimes we react instinctively. We're not even aware of it before it's too late, because of that lack of ability to focus properly, lack of ability to actually be properly mindful. So the best way to start is right here. You ready? Okay.